There's a bit of an inside joke or an internal conversation that tends to take place amongst our clergy team with respect to this particular Sunday on the church calendar. This Sunday is the final Sunday in what's called ordinary time, this long season of Pentecost that begins around early summer and culminates right before Advent, which we begin next Sunday. And this Sunday is traditionally referred to as the Feast of Christ the King. For whatever reason, over the last few years, my esteemed colleague Mary Erickson has been the priest assigned to preach on Christ the King Sunday. And the inside joke is that, of course, it's left to the only female priest on our staff to take on this theme of Christ's kingship with its associated sort of associated ideas of masculinity and, I'll say with a tongue in my cheek, to dismantle the patriarchy, if you want to be dramatic about it. And I've always said, oh my goodness, but I would so love the opportunity to preach on Christ the King, but what I'd love to do is flip the script and preach a sermon on Christ the Queen. And here, beloved, here is my opportunity to preach my sermon on Christ the Queen. And I mean to preach a sermon on Christ the Queen, not to be provocative, and certainly not to be politically divisive, but I mean to preach a sermon on Christ's queenship as a way of addressing what I think is a significant issue within the church, in this country, and around the world that I would diagnose as a limitation or a failure or an impoverishment in our theological imagination. As human beings over the centuries, trying to wrap our limited minds and intellects around this great mystery that is the divine and the ways in which God relates to human creatureliness, we tend to cast God in our own image and extrapolate from our own experience. We might say to ourselves, I need a God who can provide protection and sustenance and nourishment. And who typically does that? Perhaps a father figure with these associated virtues that we kind of ascribe to men as providing protection and security, perhaps teaching, perhaps discipline. But we always need to counterbalance that type of a metaphor with its associated counterpart. If we talk about God as a father, we also need to talk about God as a mother, with these associated qualities that we ascribe to maternal love, being nurturing, being nursing, swaddling us perhaps, welcoming us home when we find ourselves falling short or in a place of confusion or frustration. There are definitely parts of sacred scripture when Christ is referred to as a king, most notably this passage in John's gospel. But when we see Christ living and moving through the world, he also loves with a fierce, protective love that I would identify with a maternal type of love. And if we were to ask someone like Carl Jung, a depth psychologist, I think he would say that Jesus, as God incarnate in human form, is a fully integrated human with a perfect balance of the masculine or animus energy and the feminine anima energy. So what would it mean to imagine Christ in his queenship alongside his kingship? Well, in this moment that we're given in John's gospel, Jesus stands before Pilate in this place of judgment. It's a few hours after he's been arrested and a few hours before he's crucified. And Pilate has gotten wind of this rumor that Jesus is some sort of a king. People are perceiving him as taking on this messianic role that's identified with kingship. And when Pilate learns he's a king, he asks Jesus about this directly. Are you a king? People say you're a king. And I think Pilate kind of thinks he has Jesus figured out. He has him placed in this moment, in his own sort of worldview. Pilate is the Roman governor of Judea, and he knows how to deal with kings. He thinks, okay, I know how to address myself to this character in front of me, someone who provides for a larger group of people and maybe seeks his own advancement to some degree. But Jesus' response is brilliant. It kind of reminds me of those interviews you read with like the Beatles or Bob Dylan in the first parts of their career, where cultural critics will try to pin them down on a certain issue and get it a sense of what they're doing, and they just kind of brush them off, like they're playing a totally different game. And Jesus' response is similar. Pilate says, "So, are you the king of the Jews?" And his response is, "Well, you say that I am." Jesus is a kind of monarch, but the realm that he envisions presiding over is something entirely outside of Pilate's capacity to imagine. When Jesus is thinking of the reign of God, he has this vision that we get in those Old Testament prophets like Daniel or in the revelation to St. John of this ultimate Jerusalem, this new Eden, where all people will once again live in communion with God and one another, where there won't need to be any sun to shine by day or any moon to light the sky at night, because Christ, who is both monarch and tender lamb, will be the light within that city, and every tear will be wiped away from every eye. It's kind of a maternal vision of love, at least to me. So what about this feast of Christ the King? Short little history lesson. Christ the King Sunday is probably the newest or the youngest feast that we find on the church calendar. It was invented in 1925 by the Catholic Pope Pius XI in the wake of World War I. And Pius looked around throughout Christendom and saw how many Christians and how many individuals were divided over questions of political allegiance. People were giving their allegiance to different heads of state, and Pius thought people should all unite, especially Christians, under the banner of Christ the King. It's a beautiful unifying gesture that then the Church of England, the Anglican Communion worldwide takes on, and we celebrate it today, but I've always just found myself feeling a little bit of discomfort with this whole imagery of Christ as King. Maybe that's just because I'm an American and we all have sort of uncomfortable connotations with the notion of monarchy. It feels very British, very foreign. And this week, as I tried to imagine into this metaphor of Christ's kingship, I couldn't come up with a good example of an earthly king whose way of being in the world at all resembles Christ. And I started to wonder, are there queens around us, queens throughout history, that in some way might serve as kind of icons, as a window to the divine to show us what Christ's monarchic rule would look like? So the first queen who came to mind for me is one beloved of all Episcopalians and Anglicans, Queen Elizabeth I. Queen Elizabeth I ruled in the 16th century, just a little bit after Henry VIII, when the Church of England, the Anglican Church, came into being. But it was Elizabeth who really helped give Anglicanism its identity. She kind of brokered this balance between the Catholic Church on one hand and the Protestant Reformation on the other. She knew that it was important to hang on to the traditions of the Catholic Church, to the beauty of the sacraments, but that she needed to infuse this movement with that Reformation spirit that prioritized every being's having an absolute and individual relationship to God without the mediation of the clergy. It's under Elizabeth I that we get the Book of Common Prayer. It was written in English, a language that anyone who could read could read. And for Elizabeth, what was going to define this new movement, this new denomination, was going to be the way that it prayed in common. Prayer would be what defined Anglican people. But Elizabeth is so embroiled in these like political disputes and theological debates and just feels lost to me in the mists of history. So I wanted to try again. well, what about this beloved monarch in our time and age who took Elizabeth as her namesake, Queen Elizabeth II? QE2 was Britain's longest reigning monarch, and she helped steer the British people and uphold this scepter of rule through the upheaval and the confusion of the 20th century, through the political careerism and fractiousness of the 21st century. And in the midst of that political fighting and divisiveness, she sort of held on to this standard of a mythical British identity, that Brits could sort of trace their lineage back to these ancient kings and knights and lords and ladies. And it's a beautiful vision, but it's so British. It's so very British. And as an American, as all Americans, I think that from way before 1776, we've had this kind of allergy to the idea of monarchy. So for me to find an image of queenship that felt resonant and real and pertinent, I had to look a little bit closer home. And the image of queenship that came to mind for me is our beloved matriarch here in Jackson, the Queen of the Tetons, Grizzly 399. I imagine, I hear those awes, those wistful sighs, that all of you have also been mourning the loss of this incredible creature who blessed our valley for so many years. 399 for me is this sort of emblem of maternal love, of a fierce maternal love in her resourcefulness and her resilience, living 28 years upon this earth in this valley and raising at least 22 cubs. Grizzly 399 also was incredibly risky in her love. She took on with boldness and courage the risk of raising her cubs by the roadside, knowing that to be near the roadside would deter any boars from coming to eat their cubs. Ultimately, raising cubs by the roadside was what cost 399 her life. And in that sense, we might say that she gave her life for her cubs in this sort of self-sacrificial way that almost feels a little Christ-like. Lately, I've been reading a beautiful book called Grizzly Confidential that's written by a local author named Kevin Grange. Kevin Grange is a paramedic firefighter, and this book, Grizzly Confidential, which we'll be discussing at Campfire in a couple weeks, is an amazing love letter to 399 and to the whole Ursus Arctos species, all grizzlies everywhere. And in his book, Kevin says some amazing things about the spiritual significance of grizzly bears throughout history. For many indigenous cultures and shamanic cultures, bears, because they hibernate in the winter and reemerge each spring, are seen as sort of figures of death and resurrection. They go into that hibernaculum each winter and they revive again each spring as buds burst from the melted snow. But the most fascinating piece of wisdom I gleaned from this text had to do with the unique intelligence grizzly bears hold and carry through the world. We all know that grizzly bears are incredibly intelligent creatures. They can use tools to access food. They're incredibly resourceful. They have individual unique personalities. But the most fascinating piece of information I learned had to do with this intelligence that they embody. In a conversation with a wildlife biologist who worked for Alaska Fish and Game, Kevin reports this insight from a biologist named Larry Van Dale, who says that bears are able to smell time and to see smells. To smell time. What in the world does this biologist mean? Here's the way he describes it. A grizzly bear's sense of smell is 3 to 4 times as strong as a bloodhound's and 3 to 400 times as strong as a human's. And when a grizzly bear approaches a trail and sees it stretching left to right, if a human or a predator or some sort of prey has passed along that trail, it's left with it a scent that evaporates or denatures at a consistent rate. So when the grizzly comes to the trail, it can tell this human was here at a certain time. The scent is weaker on this side, a little stronger in the middle, and even stronger at this end. So they're given almost a scentscape that reorients them to history in a way and to time in a way that we humans can't really comprehend. Similarly, if a grizzly bear sees another creature, it's able to perceive its scent the way we might see campfire smoke eddying from a fire. They can see where it originates and where it dissipates as it moves into the wind. What in the world does a grizzly bear's sense of smell and the fact that it can smell time have to do with us as followers of Jesus and this idea of Christ's queenship? In that moment, when Jesus is discoursing with Pilate, I think that he is tapping into another order of intelligence that we can barely fathom of human as human beings. Just like Grizzly 399 is able to smell time in this amazing way for us to contemplate, so is Jesus able to tap in to a wider horizon view of human experience and what constitutes our history and our nature. A few verses after this passage, Pilate says to Jesus, "Do you not know?" And he's getting frustrated, I think, at this moment. He says, "Do you not know, Jesus, that I have the power to either condemn you to death or to let you free?" And Jesus remains grounded in his sense of self and says, "Pilate, you would have no power whatsoever unless it was handed over to you from above." Jesus puts things in a proper perspective. In that moment, he's able to feel his fear and move into courage. He's able to feel despair and harness hope and feel grief and move into love. And it's because of this wide horizon 399 type appreciation he has of human history. Jesus knows, like a bear approaching that trail, where humans have come from. And he knows where humans are going. He knows that there was a time when human creatures lived in perfect communion with God, part of this created order that God speaks into being and calls good, and that in Eden, we walked with God in the cool of the evening breeze, and that where we're headed is that new Eden where all people live in communion with one another and with their God, and all those tears are wiped away from every eye. And because he knows where we've been and where we're going, he's able to embody love and courage and hope in that present moment and ultimately to play a different game, to refuse to meet violence with violence or answer worldly power with worldly power. He's able to give himself in that same sacrificial way that 399 fiercely loved her last cub till the end. Some of you may know that I love to trail run, and I have this sort of psychotic tradition of running the Teton Crest Trail every year on my birthday. This year, I was a little late in pursuing this tradition, and I didn't get out onto the trail until late October when snows had already settled into the Alpine. And as I pulled my car into the String Lake parking lot early one morning, there was not another vehicle to be seen. And as I moved up that trail, what I felt mostly was an intense sense of trepidation, but also exhilaration. I knew that without more foot traffic, I'd be more likely to see a grizzly. And so I spent that first 2 hours banging my trekking poles together and singing Red Hot Chili Pepper lyrics at the top of my lungs and calling out, "You, you." And after about an hour of this, I started asking myself the question, who am I calling out to? That "you" felt sort of like a prayer kind of like a prayer to everywhere or to God or to the bears for either protection or safe passage. But in that moment, what I also realized is that my heart was big enough to hold a whole variety of emotions at once, that I could feel this intense fear and also this exhilaration, that I could be self-punishing and wonder what in the heck was I doing, putting myself at risk potentially, but also to feel this total joy and freedom in being out in the wilds in this way that kind of like gets me back in touch with my animal instincts. When I'm out there, I feel like I become all bear or maybe all prey, but there's part of me that's like all instinct, that I'm listening to every sound and rustle in the branches and feeling utterly, totally alive. And I believe that my challenge often is trying to carry such moments back from the mountainside into my life in the valley. Because the truth is, friends, we're all making our way down some sort of a trail. We're making our way down a trail, and often it feels like we're in the midst of the dark woods with threatening beasts all around us. Or sometimes we're standing before a pilot figure, standing in judgment, wondering if we have what it takes to measure up. And the invitation of Jesus, of Christ the Queen, is to maintain that wide scope view of who it is we are, where we come from, and where we're going. To hold in our minds and hearts that truth that we are made in God's image, that we are hardwired for love, acceptance, and belonging, and where we're headed is this place of ultimate union with the divine. And in the midst of that, we're able to stand firm and move from fear into courage, from our despair to harness hope, and from this place of grief, of anger, or sadness, to harness a little bit more love to spread with those around us. So friends, may you feel always a deeply felt sense of your belovedness, of this fact that you're made in God's image, you're destined for union with your God, and may you be filled with a fierce, maternal, 399 type love every hour of your life. Amen.